Rusty didn't want to delay his return to the ranger camp any longer than necessary, but disliked leaving the Monahans such a mess to clean up for themselves. He decided a couple more days should do no harm, considering how much time he'd already lost in recuperation and in the trip here. Few Indian incursions had been discovered in recent weeks. He had persuaded the two boys to stay, too. They could ride back together when they had the Shannon place in better shape, the woodpile replenished, and Rusty's cattle accounted for. The latter task proved harder than he'd thought. After a wide sweep failed to turn up half as many cattle as he thought should be there, he had decided to ride over to Tom Blessing's place to ask if Blessing knew anything about them. He had yearned to see at least a few old friends anyway, and Blessing was at the top of the list along with Preacher Webb. Riding up to the Blessing cabin, he saw a face he knew well, the black man, Shanty. Isaac York's slave sat on a bench beside the door, soaking up the winter sunshine. Rusty reined to a stop and considered turning back, but stubbornness demanded that he not retreat. He tied his reins to a post. Shanty stood up, his face troubled.
Mr. Rusty, you back to stay?
Just another day or two. Came to see Tom Blessing.
He gone someplace. Mr. Isaac's inside, waiting for him. You ain't come for trouble with Mr. Isaac, I hope.
Didn't know he was here till I saw you. I wouldn't have come if I'd known.
I'd have told you before, it wasn't Mr. Isaac killed your daddy.
I didn't come for trouble, and there won't be any unless he starts it.
Oh, he won't start nothing. Mr. Isaac's a sick man. He looked different than the last time you seen him.
Isaac York stepped outside.
Tom?
He stopped, dumbfounded at the sight of Rusty.
I heard talking, thought Tom had come back.
He stood awkwardly, one foot on the step, one on the ground. He made no move to extend his hand, nor did Rusty. Rusty felt paralyzed. It had not entered his mind that he might find York here. Though Shanty had warned him, he was surprised by York's gaunt, pallid look. The man appeared to have shrunk. His eyes seemed sunk back into his head and surrounded by darkness.
I ain't armed.
I'm not either. This is Tom Blessing's farm. I've got no wish to bloody his ground.
I never did want to fight with you. What happened to your daddy? That wasn't none of my doing.
Rusty did not believe him, but he was determined to let the matter rest for now. Someday, when the time was right, he would call for an accounting if nature did not beat him to it. York's look indicated that he might not be long for this world.
Tell Tom I came by. He'll understand why I didn't stay.
He felt the rifle beneath his leg. It would be easy to draw it from the scabbard and shoot Isaac York where he stood. He had to struggle to keep himself from reaching down. But York was not armed. Killing him under these circumstances would be murder, as brutal as the murder of Mike Shannon. He would not allow himself to look behind him, though his back itched with anxiety. It would be easy for York to step into the cabin and fetch out one of Tom Blessing's rifles and shoot Rusty from behind, as Daddy Mike had been shot. To turn and look would be to admit fear, and that he would not do. Not for the miserable likes of Isaac York. As he rode, he felt a rising of confidence that York was not going to shoot him. He wondered why. A mile from Blessing's cabin, he saw a wagon coming toward him. Tom Blessing's familiar figure perched on the seat. By this time, Rusty's pulse had slowed back to normal. He raised his hand in greeting. Blessing saw it on the reins.
Rusty Shannon! Didn't know you were anywhere around.
Just a few days. Brought some folks to stay on my place till the war's foolishness slows down.
You been to my house? Sorry I wasn't there. Been to the settlement to get some supplies to carry my wife till I get back from my trip.
Trip? To where?
Up north of here, town of Jacksboro. I've been working for the Confederate Army, buying horses. Supposed to meet some dealers up there the first of next week. How about turning around and going back to the cabin with me? Wife will fix dinner.
I better not. I found Isaac York there.
Rusty, I hope you didn't...
No, I didn't. Not that I didn't study on it some. Hard as it was, I left him be. For now.
Well, I'm glad. Lord willing, you've got a long life ahead of you. You wouldn't want to do something foolish and ruin it.
I don't see that it's foolish to want to even up the score for Daddy Mike.
Been a many a wrong done in the name of the war. This included. Folks will have to learn to put the wrongs aside and get on with living.
It'll be hard. I don't know if I can.
You'll have to. Either that or go to the brush with blood on your hands. I don't think you've got it in you to turn outlaw. Mike Shannon taught you better than that.
Daddy Mike was a fighter.
So are you. And the toughest fight you face may be against yourself.
I can't find near all the cattle I ought to have. You know anything about them?
Can't say I do exactly, but I've got suspicions. I think Fowler Gaskin and his boys helped themselves, so the conscript men drugged the boys off to the army.
Nah, I didn't figure they went of their own accord.
You never heard grown men bawling and carrying on like them boys did, or cuss like the old man. He kept hollering till they was plumb across the county line. Said he'd starve to death without them boys of his to take care of him.
He wasn't gonna starve as long as one beef critter was left on my place. Did you know he'd taken up living in my cabin? I had to run him off so the folks I brought would have a place to stay.
I told him several times he had no call to be over there, but he kept telling me it was only temporary. I'm sorry I didn't run him off myself, but I've been away a lot, working for the government.
It's done now.
Geneva was almost done preparing the family's meager supper. She smiled in relief.
I was afraid you wouldn't get back in time to eat with everybody else.
I could smell your good cooking for the last 2 miles. I wasn't going to miss it.
What's wrong?
I'd figured on staying a few days, but I can't. First thing in the morning, I'm starting back.
She stared at him, holding a skillet until the handle's heat forced her to set it down quickly.
But why?
If I stay here, I'm liable to kill a man.
That fellow York?
I saw him today.
But you didn't kill him.
Not this time. But next time I might. It's best I don't take the chance.
She made a step toward him.
I was hoping... What you need is time.
I've been gone more than a year. Thought I'd put the worst of it behind me. But I saw him and it all came back strong as ever.
This is your home. You can't stay away forever.
If I killed him, I'd have to. This way, I'm just leaving a few days quicker than I figured on. A few days don't make a lot of difference.
Everything is so uncertain in these times. A few days might be all we have.
She came into his arms. Old Vince Purdy walked in, stopped in surprise, then quietly withdrew.
What do you suppose he's thinking?
Same as I am, I reckon. That it's high time I get myself back to Belknap.
He expected a stern lecture from Captain Whitfield about his having stayed away longer than planned. But the officer seemed glad to see him. He mentioned that he'd lost a couple more men who decided to join the Confederate Army, and only one replacement had as yet shown up.
How we're expected to hold this line, I don't know. If the Comanches and Kiowas ever take it in their heads to come across in numbers like on the Linville raid, there's no telling how far they might go. There have been rumors about Kansas Jayhawkers up in the territory, agitating for them to do just that.
The Indians don't need anybody from outside to agitate them. They've got reasons enough on their own, especially the Tonkawas after being exiled.
You hear any talk about horse thieves down where you went?
Didn't talk to many people, but Indians haven't penetrated that far in a good while.
I'm not talking Indians. At least I don't think so. Seems like there's been a mild epidemic around the settlements over east. Horses turning up missing. Most people blame Indians, but we haven't found that much Indian sign.
Rusty remembered that somebody had run off a number of the Monahan horses the night the Monahan house had been burned. And Caleb Dawkins had complained about missing horses after James Monahan's retaliatory raid, though Rusty was sure James had not taken them.
The Army's buying all the horses it can get and not asking many questions. It's not likely it's buying any of them from Indians. As I see it, it's white men doing the stealing.
Anybody in particular?
There's some people around Belknap I wouldn't trust with a blind mule. Or else it's some of the renegades in the brush waiting out the war. They're a mix of conscript dodgers and wanted men.
Even if they snuck into the settlements and did the stealing, those men from the brush couldn't afford to be seen. Somebody would have to help them sell the horses to the army.
That is the way I figure.
Rusty remembered what Tom Blessing had said when he met him driving his wagon.
I've got a friend back home buying horses for the government. He told me he's fixing to meet some horse dealers up this way.
Did he say where?
Town of Jacksboro.
Might be interesting if we just happen to be passing through when those horses come in.
Tom Blessing is as honest as anybody you ever met.
Blessing? I remember that name. Seems like I even rode with him a time or two.
He used to be a friend of old Captain Burmeister. He wouldn't be a party to horse stealing.
Not intentionally, but if he lives way down on the Colorado River, he probably doesn't know the people at Jacksboro or around here either. He has to take them at their word.
For that matter, I don't know anybody over there.
But I do. They've had a right smart of Indian trouble since Jacksboro got started. Nobody's apt to get suspicious if we go over that way looking for fresh Indian sign.
Whitfield, Rusty, Tanner, and the Morris brothers had set up camp west of Jacksboro, a small farming and stock-raising town of modest log and lumber houses, hard hit in the past by Indian raids and surviving hard times on the most tenuous basis. From afar, the rangers had watched Tom Blessing arrive on the second day with his wagon, a saddle horse tied behind. He had raised his tent beside a set of log corrals.
I'd like to go and say howdy. I've known him as far back as I can remember.
I don't doubt your friend's honesty, but he might say something to flush our quail. Last thing we want to do is to attract undue attention. We're out here looking for Indians, remember?
The following day, Rusty saw a cloud of dust. Lack of rain had left the grass short, the surface dry. Anywhere an animal walked, it left a tiny dust trail slow to settle behind it. The size of this cloud indicated many animals. The captain held a spyglass to his eye and focused it.
Looks like 20 horses, give or take a few. We'll wait till they get them penned, then mosey down for a look.
Rusty was not as calm and cool as the captain. Whitfield moved slowly and deliberately, as if he had all day.
Never get in a hurry when you don't have to, Rusty. A man in too big a hurry makes mistakes he can't afford. Let the other man be the one who makes mistakes.
Their approach went unnoticed until they'd almost reached the corral. Tom Blessing had his back turned. He was examining a gray horse's teeth.
He's a sight older than that.
Blessing turned, eyes widening in surprise, then smiling as he recognized Rusty.
Rusty Shannon, you're about the last man I expected to see here so far from home.
The man beside him turned. Rusty recognized Pete Dawkins and somehow felt no surprise. Dawkins' face fell as his gaze swept over the rangers. Nearby, a rope in his hand, stood another man Rusty was sure had been with Pete the day they were trying to escape with the stolen Tonkawa horses. Whitfield looked straight at Pete.
You are Colonel Dawkins' son, aren't you?
Yeah.
I would assume these are some of the Colonel's horses you brought to sell?
Yeah, part of them. Bought the rest from farmers around.
I assume you have bills of sale.
Pete looked toward his horse. The man with the rope was by the fence where his and Pete's mounts were tied outside.
Got the papers in my saddlebag. I'll fetch them for you.
He climbed over the fence near his horse and companion. Quickly, they jerked their reins loose. They spurred the horses into a dust-raising hard run on the wagon road that ran through Jacksboro. Tanner drew his rifle and aimed.
Don't shoot. You might hit some innocent person in town.
Tanner lowered the rifle.
From what I've heard, there ain't no innocent people in this town.
A few. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt.
Them boys are getting away.
I think we all know where they're going.
I'm just guessing, but I'd have to figure the government won't be getting these horses.
Not unless the government encourages horse thieves. Johnny Morris, you stay here and take charge of these animals. The rest of you follow me.
Sorry to bust up your trade, Tom.
You all may need a witness. I'll saddle up and go with you.
Whitfield did not have to say where they were going. Rusty knew long before he saw the big house where Colonel Dawkins lived. Several of the Dawkins farmhands stood silently watching the rangers ride into the yard. Rusty studied one face after another, uneasy. One order from Caleb Dawkins, and none of the rangers might leave here alive. Whitfield studied the house before he dismounted.
Shannon, you come with me. Tanner, Morris, Mr. Blessing, you all stand watch out here. You may have to cover our leaving if things don't go well.
Rusty had a pistol on his hip, but he'd always trusted the rifle more. He drew it as they ascended the few steps up to the long veranda. A man stood just inside the doorway that led into a hall. Caleb Dawkins, who had always looked 7 feet tall, seemed smaller than Rusty had remembered him. His broad shoulders sagged. His face appeared the gray of riverbank mud, his eyes dull and dispirited.
Come in, Captain. The men you seek are here.
Pete Dawkins and the other man who had fled Jacksboro sat in straight chairs in the parlor. They looked as if they'd been whipped. A middle-aged woman stood beside Pete with tears in her eyes.
Amity, you best leave the room.
You can't do this to our son.
Our son has done it to himself. You best go and let me talk to the captain.
Papa, please.
Pete asked me to help him get away. He told me what he'd done. He and Scully here and some of those renegades out in the brush. They stole from others and they stole from me. This is my reward for keeping you out of the army. I've had men hanged for less than what he's done. He's my son. I can't have him hanged. But I can turn him over to you and let the law take its course.
I can't say what a court might do. Stealing horses is a penitentiary offense.
No Dawkins has ever gone to the penitentiary. We've always gone the last mile to uphold the law. The thought of a son of mine in that place.
I might suggest one thing. I can take him into custody and turn him over to the conscript officers. He'd do his country more good in the army than in the pen.
Son, you shamed us. You've brought dishonor on the Dawkins family name. The army might give you a chance to redeem yourself.
Papa, a man could get killed in the army.
He can get himself hung for a horse thief on the outside. So you'll go and serve your country. You too, Scully. The army will make men of you or it'll kill you.
He walked to the door through which his wife had gone. He turned.
They're yours, Captain. Take them.
Captain Whitfield motioned for Pete and Scully to stand up.
You boys are under arrest. Try to run again and we'll shoot you.
Pete looked toward the door where his father had disappeared. He opened his mouth as if to shout something, then changed his mind and hung his head.
We won't run. Next time he'd hang us himself. He told us so.
Whitfield looked back toward the house as they rode across the yard.
Shannon, if you know some way to get word to James Monahan, tell him there's no use trying anymore to kill Caleb Dawkins. Pete has already done that.
Colonel still looked alive the last we saw him.
Walking, breathing, sure. But this has hurt him worse than any bullet ever could. It'll eat on him like a cancer. It'll kill his soul.
In a peculiar way, Rusty felt that the Monahans had been avenged.
High Plains Comanche Encampment, 1863.
Buffalo Caller sat in the council circle so long that his arthritic joints had stiffened and were beginning to ache. A horse had stumbled and rolled over him during a buffalo hunt last fall, leaving him with chronic pains he had never felt before. The council was considering Buffalo Caller's proposal for an invasion on a scale not seen since the great raid that had carried him and so many others all the way to the big water, chasing terrified whites out into the surf. He was ready to do it again. It was high time that the land-hungry Texans felt once more the fury of the people. The council, however, did not share his enthusiasm for a massive strike. He could not understand the reluctance.
The time now is perfect. The white men are so busy in their war against one another that their defenses have almost fallen apart. Most of their fighting men have been sent away to kill their own kind. They are vulnerable enough now to be pushed back from all our lands. Only a tattered group on horseback guard their settlements. Such a line should be easy to breach. With help of benevolent spirits, the destruction will be great.
You and I have both seen the Texan settlements. Even with their war, the hair faces have become thicker to the east of us than winter hair on the back of a horse.
There was a time we could have stopped them easily, but we waited. We thought the Mexicans would turn them back, or the land itself, but they continue to come. If we wait much longer, the white men's war will end, and there will be twice as many of them. This is the time to be bold.
Buffalo Caller used a pointed stick to draw a crude map in the sand. He indicated the course of the Colorado River, far south of the Red.
This is the Talking Water River. As a young man, I hunted there. Many times since the Texans built their houses, I have gone and taken horses from them.
Many more Texans live there now.
And many more horses. The Texans to the south and east are not as ready as those to the north. They no longer expect us.
But the searchers are out all the time. They will find our trail.
Not if first we go far west where they do not ride. Then we go far south before we turn and move into the Talking Water settlements.
Are there not white men to the west?
Only a few. They are fugitives. Even if they see us, they cannot send warning. They hide from the white man's law.
Blackwing's frown told Buffalo Caller he was resistant to the whole notion. He was already rich enough in horses, and many of the people did not share Buffalo Caller's strong compulsion to drive the white man away. After all, most Comanches remained at large. Though they had lost homelands to the south, they still ranged in relative freedom across the high plains. Most had not allowed themselves to be gathered like cattle and confined to the reservation north of the clay-colored river, the way less resistant tribes had done, or the white man's pet dogs, the despised Tonkawas. The Comanches could still hunt buffalo unimpeded, so long as they did not venture too far eastward into areas infested by the white men. Buffalo Caller felt a sour letdown. He stood up and left the council circle. He had lost the argument, but at least there was an alternative. Above all, a male Comanche was a free man, allowed to act on his own volition if the way of the others did not please him. If the council would not agree upon a huge raid, he could organize a smaller one of his own. He had always found young men ready to follow him. Already he was visualizing the country he would cover, the circuitous western route by which he would make his way down to the Colorado River settlements with the least chance of discovery. He knew the farms where he had found horses and mules before, and where he would likely find them again. But this time he would do more than simply take the white men's animals. He would make a concerted effort to take as many of their scalps as possible. Those he did not kill, he would leave frightened for their lives. The survivors would be glad to gather their families and leave the land that had been Comancheria since the time of his grandfather's fathers. But before he began, he would need, among other things, to repeat the vision quest ritual he had undertaken as a young man first seeking his guardian spirits. He would ask those spirits for a renewal of the power he had known in his youth, that he might bring down the people's full wrath upon the Texans. Granted that power, he and others would regain the land that was the Comanche's own by every right a warrior held sacred. Buffalo Caller's son, Steals the Ponies, had accompanied him to the hill chosen for the vigil so he could take his horse back to the encampment. Formerly known as Jackrabbit, his son had earned a new name after leading several young men in stealing army horses right out of the military corrals one moonlit night last fall. They had not so much as awakened a sentry. Any father would have cause for pride in such a bold stealer of the soldiers' mounts. In 4 days, his son would return. 6 on the buffalo robe he had spread over the ground, he lit his pipe. Smoke blew in each of the 4 principal directions, then down toward the earth and up toward the sky. He would not eat or drink until he saw a vision that would guide him. Often it came on the 4th day or night, for 4 was a number that held much power. 4 days was a long time, but Buffalo Caller could wait. Infinite patience was one attribute of a good warrior. By the close of the 3rd day, his vision was blurring because of self-imposed deprivations. He considered this good. Unimportant details faded, and he could better see the intentions of the spirits, better hear their voices above the whisper of prairie wind through the dry grass. He was not aware of dropping off to sleep. It was as if he drifted without effort from the conscious world to one in which dreams became reality. He saw around him a great mass of warriors and more horses than there were buffalo on the plains. He saw the white man's houses and felt the ground tremble as the invaders mounted a charge upon them. He saw the warriors' mouths open wide as they raised their voices in a grand cry for victory. Yet there was no sound, only silence, only feeling. It was a wondrous thing, puzzling. He saw himself on the ground and saw the Texan horsemen rushing down upon him, swarming like angry bees. But most passed on, disappearing into a haze. Only one remained. Buffalo Caller realized with a start that though this was a grown man, he had the face of the boy once captured, then lost. And his hair was red like blood. Buffalo Caller was cold, yet sweating. He looked around him, but saw little in the darkness, except the sparkling of the stars above, and a moon round and white and bright. He gathered the robe over his shoulders to stop his trembling. He wanted to grasp the dream and hold it in his hands for study, to determine what it was meant to tell him. But dreams are elusive, and the details faded before his eyes. He could hold the essence of this one. The fall, the red-haired Texan, a sense of emptiness. He added a few dry sticks to coax the flames of his fire. He sat hunched in the robe, staring into the flames, trying to decide what the spirits had told him. They did not always speak clearly. He had much to ponder. Now, from the cover of timber along the river, he peered out onto a rolling prairie where scattered horses grazed. They were an inviting target. Too inviting.
We have already come far. We are likely to be discovered soon. We may be forced to turn back with our hands empty. I say we should take these horses and be content.
We agreed before we came. We would not strike a blow until we are deep in the Texan country. As we go out, we will leave a trail of fire. Those who survive will run like rabbits, and our land will be rid of them.
Buffalo Caller had led his group of 20 warriors, mostly young and eager for plunder, far to the west before dropping southeastward toward the Colorado River settlements. He counted on being able to make a deep penetration, as he had done several times in the past, before his band attracted attention. To stay hidden, Buffalo Caller had forced his warriors to stop riding in daylight. Tall Eagle pointed through the trees. The once enthusiastic warriors had become distracted from their larger goal by discoveries of lesser prizes. Several times they had been tempted by small herds of horses, but Buffalo Caller always refused, holding out for maximum destruction.
There stands a white man's house. You seem more interested in blood than in horses. We can take them by surprise and kill them all, then capture the horses.
Having already spotted the house, Buffalo Caller looked again, trying to determine how many might be living there and how strong their defense might be. So far, he had seen only one man, and by the way he walked, he was old. He had seen two women and two or three children. He thought it probable that the young men of the family were away to the big war. He remembered this log house. He'd picked up several horses and mules here once, adding them to a large band taken farther to the east.
I say we go farther, because once we strike, there will be no more surprise. Everywhere else they will gather and wait for us. The spirits have favored us so far, but if we are foolish, they will turn away.
You dream. The white men will never give up our lands. There are too many, and they keep coming. We can no more kill them all than the wolves can kill all the buffalo. But we can do like the wolves and feed from them. We can take their horses. We can even take their cattle and trade them to the Mexican Comancheros.
My father is right. Why be content with hooves and tails when we can have the whole animal?
Buffalo Caller turned, pride warming him. His son was not inclined to speak often, but when he spoke, he showed he had inherited his father's wisdom.
The next time we find many horses, we will take them and turn back.
They watched as another white man arrived at the cabin. He and the old man led the new arrival's horse to the barn and turned him loose. The young Comanches were pleased because this meant one more horse for the taking. Buffalo Caller was pleased because this was one more white man to die when the time came. The band remained in the timber, waiting for darkness to cover their movement. Rusty Shannon had been brushing Alamo's back when he saw a rider approach the ranger camp, his horse lathered with sweat. Private Tanner was leading his own horse back from the water.
Feller coming yonder must be carrying a powerful message. He's fixing to kill his horse.
Rusty put the brush into a wooden box and squinted. Something about the rider looked vaguely familiar.
I do believe that's James Monahan. He wouldn't come out of hiding without there's a strong reason for it.
Monahan? Ain't he the one who...
That's him.
Rusty tied Alamo to a tree and sprinted toward the camp headquarters.
Captain Whitfield! Somebody coming!
Whitfield stepped out of the open-fronted tent. James hit the ground, and his anxious gaze fell immediately upon the captain.
You the man in charge?
I am, sir.
What's your business?
Indians. A sizable bunch of them. A good ways west of here and on their way south.
You saw them yourself?
Sure as hell did. Me and a preacher. He found the trail real fresh, and we both followed it a ways till we almost ran up on them from behind.
How many?
20 or so. Enough to do a right smart of mischief.
Say they were a long way west of here. There's very few people to the west of this place. What were you doing out there?
For the first time, James spotted Rusty. He made a tiny nod of acknowledgement.
Trying to stay out of sight.
Rusty realized that Whitfield had not seen James before and had no reason to recognize him. He wished now he had not said anything to Tanner. Though the lanky ranger was a talkative sort, he could hold his silence when necessary. Rusty intended to tell him it was necessary.
Why would Indians ride so far west if they're on the warpath? There are no people out there for them to raid except maybe a few camps of deserters and renegades.
Me and the preacher, we figured they were trying to travel without being seen. They'd go south, maybe down as far as the Colorado, then cut east and hit the lower settlements.
And where is this preacher?
He figured to circle around and get ahead of them, then warn the folks living in their way. I come to fetch you and your company.
We'll furnish you a fresh horse. You intend to come with us, don't you?
Damn betcha. I got folks somewhere down yonder.
With the captain out of sight, Rusty caught James as he transferred his saddle to a fresh horse.
Could give me away, Rusty. How come you didn't?
Looks to me like he's pretty well figured you out as it is. He's got you pegged for a fugitive from the conscript, and maybe one of them renegade horse thieves in the brush to boot. The only thing he doesn't know is that you're the man who tried to kill Caleb Dawkins.
You gonna tell him?
I'll keep my mouth shut unless he asks me. But I won't lie to him. You took a big chance coming here.
Wasn't no choice. Preacher Webb knows how to find my family and warn them. I don't know where your farm is. Me and Preacher Webb been keeping pretty close touch. He was on his way out to see me when he came upon that fresh Indian trail.
If it hadn't been for worrying about your family, would you have come and told us about the Indians?
I don't know. I'd have had to think about it for a while.
On Whitfield's command, 10 rangers plus James had set out in a trot. The temptation had been strong to run the horses, but the animals would tire out and break down long before they reached the Colorado. At best, it would be a hard 2 days' ride. The captain's strategy was to travel straight south. If James's theory was correct, that the Indians would turn eastward at some point, the rangers should intersect their trail without wasting extra miles. Much later, they had stopped in a stream to water the horses. The captain turned toward James.
I don't believe I heard your name.
I don't see where that matters.
I've been remembering a description I heard. You know a man named Caleb Dawkins?
I do.
I believe you are the James Monahan who attempted to kill him. Would I be guessing close?
Close enough.
I can't say that I criticize your motive. I do criticize your marksmanship.
I was a little excited. Next time I'll try to keep my head.
It's my job to see that there is no next time. Consider yourself under arrest.
You're not sending me back now, are you?
I can't spare the men. Do you give me your word that you'll stay with us?
Till we see about my folks and them Indians. After that, I ain't promising you nothing.
Fair enough. But understand this. Afterward, if you try to run, it'll be my job to stop you. Even if it takes a bullet in the back.
Looks to me like we understand each other.
James looked at Rusty.
Is that your feeling, too?
Like I told you last time, I follow orders.
The second night, Rusty guessed that they were near the river, though he could not be certain of the distance.
Halt! If we keep going, we ought to strike the Colorado pretty soon.
We may do it afoot if we don't rest these horses.
While we're resting, there's no telling what might be happening to folks downriver.
We can't help them if we can't get there, and we'll never get there on dead horses. We'll let them breathe an hour or so, and we'll see.
Rusty had taken up his position to point the way, though it was not necessary. They had been moving as nearly due south as the terrain would allow. As they approached the cabin, it looked black against the moonlight. Rusty feared it had been burned. He then realized, however, he'd been fooled by the deep shadow. The cabin was intact. Motioning for the others to stay a safe distance behind, he put Alamo into a walk and carefully approached the house.
Anybody home?
No one answered. He felt a chill, fearing the worst. Perhaps the Indians had already visited. If they'd been here, they almost certainly had struck other farms to the east, including his own. He moved to the door, where he found a piece of paper held down by a bent nail. He could not read it in the shadow, so he tore it off and held it up to let the moon's light fall upon it.
It says Indian sign. Gone to Shannon Place.
And let's go to the Shannon Place, too.
By the stars, Rusty guessed it was midnight or a little later by the time they reached there. He agonized all the way, fearing that he would find a place in charred ruins, its occupants slaughtered. As he rode in, James close beside him, he saw that the cabin was dark but intact. A large number of horses were held in a corral. The Indians had not struck here, not yet at least.
Thank God. I thank him too. I sure as hell do. A sentry's warning. Other end of the corral.
Hold on. We're coming in.
Who's out there?
It's me, Rusty Shannon, with some rangers.
Well, come on in and welcome. We've been expecting company, but not you.
Several men materialized from the shadows, carrying rifles. Rusty realized that several neighbors had come together for mutual protection.
James! Preacher Webb told us you'd rode for help, but it's liable to cost you, son.
He came here under arrest. Where's the preacher?
He rode on to warn the others. Said he was going back to Tom Blessing's first so Tom could help him spread the word. He'd been back and we've been worried about him. From the sign he showed us down on the river, there was a war party came by here a couple nights ago. They could have taken us then. We wouldn't have known they was around till they was on top of us.
They were saving you for their return trip.
Yeah, that's the way we see it. If it hadn't been for Preacher Webb, no telling what might have happened.
It still could.
Yeah, but now they won't catch us by surprise. We're fixing to give them a dandy scrap.
Is everybody all right? Mama and them?
Your mama's made out of rawhide. That bullet slowed her down a little bit, but it's a long way from killing her.
James turned back to the captain.
I'm going up to the house to see my folks. Any objections?
I'll go with him.
Go ahead. We'll set up camp at the corrals. There won't be any horses stolen out of here tonight.
Clemmy and Geneva were out on the dog run. Rusty doubted they'd ever gone to bed. With the threat of a raid hanging over them, they probably couldn't sleep in any case. Clemmy clasped her son in her arms.
Preacher Webb said he'd fetch you down here when he could. We didn't figure on it being this way.
She raised her gaze to Rusty.
You got him under arrest?
The captain has.
You could take your horse and lose yourself in the timber down by the river. You could be far gone by daylight.
I'm riding a ranger horse, Mama, and he's plumb give out from the trip.
There's plenty of fresh ones in the corral.
A bunch of men there to see I don't take any of them. No, I'm staying here till we know the Indian trouble's over with.
Geneva took Rusty's hand and eased him off the back side of the dog run into the shadow. She leaned in to kiss him.
I was hoping you'd come back. I've missed you.
It hasn't been all that terribly long since I left here.
I was already missing you while I watched you right away.
Tanner found Rusty on the dog run.
Captain says he'd like to see you and James Monahan down at the corral. Says you belong with the rest of the company.
He gave Geneva a moment's quiet study.
Sorry to pull him away.
We can sleep now, knowing the rangers are here.
I expect just one of them would have done, provided it was the right one.
Nobody can't get no sleep around here. People talking loud all the time.
Rusty studied the dark shape lying beside the cabin.
Now, Paolo was the first one to come here after word got out about the Indians. He's scared to stay by himself down yonder in his cabin.
He won't leave till you run him off with the club.
Well, you gotta feel sorry for him. Word came a few days ago that both his boys been killed.
Eff and Luke? I never thought the army could get them that close to the fighting.
Purdy looked back to be sure no one else could hear.
They told the old man the boys died in battle, but Tom Blessing whispered in my ear that it wasn't that way at all. They got in a fight over two French women in a New Orleans fancy house. Nearest them boys ever come to a battlefield.
Daylight brought a sense of relief, for there had been no sign of Indians. Though it was generally believed they did not like to fight at night, that was their favorite time for stealing horses, protected by darkness.
I'll leave a few men here to help guard this place. The rest of us will move east and see if we can intercept the hostiles. I'll take you with me, Shannon, and your prisoner, too. I want to keep him in sight.
My prisoner?
You lost him once. He's your responsibility.
Rusty, you gonna shoot me if I take and run?
I guess I'll have to decide about that when the time comes.
My sister wouldn't take it kindly.
I wouldn't take too much for granted, was I you.
If we run into Indians, I won't be much help without a gun.
If that happens, Monahan, I'll give you your gun back, but not before.
The captain looked around.
Everybody ready?
Rusty counted 8 riders paralleling the river. That seemed the most likely route for the Indians' return.
There's twice as many Indians as there is of us.
Daddy Mike used to tell about the big fight on Plum Creek. He said the rangers were outnumbered 4 or 5 to 1.
They whipped the Comanches anyway.
Took them by surprise, I guess.
No, the Indians knew they were there. They just thought their numbers made them safe. They didn't expect the volunteers to hit them so fast and hard. It threw them off balance, and they never got back on their feet.
They rode by the Gaskin place. The roof had been patched, after a fashion, but it was the sort of slapdash job Rusty would have expected of Fowler. He managed to muster some sympathy for the old man and the loss of his sons, despite years of grievances at Gaskin hands. James knew little about the Gaskin family.
It'd be a mercy if them Indians burned that place down. Maybe the neighbors would get together and build a better one.
They would for sure, if they could build it 50 miles away.
Farther downriver lay the Isaac York place. Rusty would rather have passed it by, for the thought of seeing York brought a bitter taste rising up from his stomach. He hoped York would not be there. Captain Whitfield raised his hand in a signal for a halt.
Quiet! Listen!
The York place was under siege. His first thought was that the Comanches would do for him what he'd not been able to do for himself, administer justice to Isaac York. He took quick satisfaction in the thought, then lost it. He felt shame for letting himself harbor such an unworthy sentiment.
You promised me my gun, remember?
Whitfield reached into his saddlebag and brought out the pistol he had taken when he placed James under arrest.
I'll want that back.
James made no promise. Whitfield signaled for the advance. Rusty pushed Alamo hard, trying to keep up. He suffered a confusing ebb and flow of conflicting emotions, pulling him forward, yet trying to hold him back. He was tempted to drop behind and leave the rescue of Isaac York to the others, but he could not bring himself to draw on the reins. Outnumbered, the Rangers needed every man they had, and more. His feeling of duty to them was stronger than his hatred for York. The cabin came into view on a slope, easy water-carrying distance up from the river. The Comanches were circling it on horseback, aiming arrows at the broken windows and door. A dead horse lay at the doorstep. Rusty guessed that a warrior tried to smash the door by backing his horse into it. The rider evidently had escaped, but his mount had not. White smoke rose from the two windows and around the door as defenders aimed at the attackers. The Indians spotted the incoming riders and quickly formed into a group, then surged toward the Rangers. The sight of the oncoming Comanches, stripped down to little more than breechclouts and war paint, set Rusty to shiver. His blood was like ice. But Whitfield did not temper his speed, nor did the other Rangers. They plunged headlong toward the massive warriors.
Chastise them, boys! Hip and thigh!
The Comanches split suddenly, avoiding an actual collision. They swept around the Rangers, aiming their arrows. Rusty instinctively dropped down on the side of his horse. One Minuteman was on the ground with an arrow in his shoulder. The horse fell, hit in the chest. So far as he could see, in the wild chaos of the moment, only two Comanches had rifles. And then there was only one. Rusty glimpsed a large gathering of horses farther down the river, prizes of the Comanche raid. Suddenly, the Indians regrouped and made a wide circle back toward the horses. They did not intend to give up their booty without a fight. Three men stepped out of the cabin, rifles in their hands. Rusty recognized Preacher Webb, Tom Blessing, and the slave Shanty. He did not see York. Perhaps the Indians had done to him what Rusty had long yearned to do.
Ah! Keep pounding them, boys! They can't fight us and drive their horses, too!
Rusty was uncertain for a moment which the warriors would choose. Then he knew, for they formed a long, ragged line. As they came forward in a run, ready for more battle, the Rangers spread out to meet them. Rusty found himself at one extreme end, racing toward a Comanche who seemed to have chosen him as his specific target. The Indian held a war club. The stone head looked as large as both of Rusty's fists. He knew it could crush his skull. He tried to line his pistol sights on the man's broad, painted chest, but the motion of his running horse kept the barrel bobbing up and down. The opposing riders were no more than 10 feet apart. He saw the other horse scotch at the flash, just enough to prevent the war club from striking Rusty's head as it swung in a wide arc. He felt himself falling. His hat rolled away. He looked up as the Indian wheeled his horse around and came back, holding a club high. Instinctively, Rusty brought up the pistol and squeezed the trigger, but the hammer fell on an empty chamber. The Buffalo Caller had been in high spirits over the success of the raid. Though he had been thwarted in gathering scalps, they had done well in gathering horses. The war party had rounded up horses in more abundance than he had dared hope. He had not been surprised when their approach to the small log cabin was greeted by gunfire. Most of the warriors had been willing to pass it by and settle for the four horses they saw in the corral. But Buffalo Caller fretted over not having taken Texan scalps. The cabin looked vulnerable, and he had led the assault. Now they stood in danger of losing all the horses they had gathered and perhaps a few of the warriors themselves. He dreaded the blame the young men would fasten upon him. Buffalo Caller wondered what manner of madman he was dealing with. The Texan's failure to be intimidated left him rattled, unsure what he should do. He looked around desperately for his son Steele's the ponies. He could not see him in the confusion. Buffalo Caller found himself facing a single rider. He had fired his rifle in the first charge and had not had a chance to reload. He did not trust his aim with an arrow from the back of a running horse against another moving horseman. He chose to use the war club. His horse scotched with a flash, just enough to prevent the war club from striking Rusty's head as he swung it in a wide arc. He wheeled his horse around and came back, holding the club high. He saw the Texan bring up a pistol and squeeze the trigger, but the hammer fell on an empty chamber. Buffalo Caller quickly raised the club, then stopped. He looked down in surprise and growing horror, for he saw what he had seen in his dream. The white man's hair was red. Buffalo Caller burned all over. Instinct told him to smash this man quickly, for the red hair was evil medicine. But his hand seemed paralyzed. He felt a struggle of opposing powers, his own against that of the red-haired Texan. He tried to bring down the club, but could not move it.
Rusty!
He saw another white man bearing down upon him. As Buffalo Caller turned to meet the new threat, he felt a renewal of power. He swung the club back for momentum. Almost falling, he managed to grasp a handful of mane, but he could not see to guide the animal. He could feel that it was still running, but he had no idea where it was going. Soon, it did not seem to matter. A slow paralysis came over him. His hand loosed its grip on the mane. Then he was lying on his back, sunlight filtering through tree branches above and burning through the lids of his closed eyes. He felt himself drifting away, as if floating in the river. The last thing that came to him was a renewal of the vision. Once again, he saw the man with the red hair. And once again, the face was that of the boy he had taken for his own, but had lost in the turmoil and fire of Plum Creek. Rusty felt a terrible pain as a hand gripped the shoulder the club had struck.
Are you shot, Rusty?
He hit me with his club. Feels like he might have busted my shoulder. He was fixing to fetch me another lick when you rode up. Thanks. You saved my life, James.
It ain't worth thanking me for. Looks like our Indian got away, but he won't go far. I put a bullet in him.
James rode out to catch Alamo as Tanner reined up, swinging a long leg over the cantle of his saddle. He bent down to give Rusty a searching look. His anxiety faded, a smile creasing his face.
Fell off your horse, did you?
I got clubbed. If James Monahan hadn't come along, I'd have my brain scattered all over the grass.
Wouldn't have been enough to make much of a mess. Come on, I'll help you up.
Rusty felt shaky on his feet, and Tanner held on to him until James brought the horse.
Where's everybody else? What happened with the Indians?
Scattered to hell and gone. Looks like we busted up their party. You know how it is with Indians. They'll go off in six directions and meet up later, somewhere they don't figure we can reach them.
They've left their horse herd behind.
But they'll be back. They'll try again. Maybe not today, but sooner or later.
That means me and you can hang on to our high-paying job.
Tanner pointed his chin toward the York cabin.
Looks like the boys are starting to gather over there. Guess we'd best go join them.
James looked toward the river. It was only 50 yards away.
Maybe they won't notice for a while that I'm not with you.
You leaving?
Promised to stay till the trouble was over. It is, so I'm getting while the getting's good.
They'll blame Rusty for you getting away.
Well, tell them it happened when him and that Indian was having their set to. Was nothing he could do about it. Ain't much either of you can do now except shoot me in the back.
Tanner drew his pistol and studied it.
I ain't had time to reload. Don't reckon Rusty has either.
And adios, Rusty. You take good care of my sister. I'll see you when the war's over.
The war back east has got to end one of these days. But I'm afraid the one out here may take a lot longer. Don't let some Comanche raise your hair.
He watched James disappear into the timber, then shifted his attention to the York cabin.
Guess we better see what's going on.
Captain Whitfield stood with his hands on his hips as Rusty dismounted, his shoulder stiff.
I don't see your prisoner.
Neither do I, sir. Things got kind of mixed up there for a little bit.
Caleb Dawkins will be upset if he finds out you had him, then lost him again.
Somehow, what Caleb Dawkins thinks doesn't mean a damn thing to me right now. Anyway, he's got other troubles on his mind, and deserves them, every one.
There's no reason he has to know, unless somebody has the poor judgment to tell him. I don't know anybody in this company who's that short of good sense.
Truth is, Captain, if it hadn't been for James Monahan, I'd be laying out yonder with my head stove in. It's a lucky thing he was there.
Preacher Webb stood at the door.
Just luck, you think? Likely it was providence that James was close by when you needed him.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And it was the Lord brought you and the Minutemen here in time. We were mighty near out of ammunition.
I'm glad we got here for your sake. As for Isaac York, I wouldn't care if the Indians plowed him under.
Webb stared critically at Rusty, then motioned him over to the side of the cabin, away from the others.
It's time you know the truth, Rusty. Tom and me, we tried for a long time to tell you we weren't sure Isaac shot your daddy, Mike. Now we know he didn't.
What do you mean he didn't?
When word came about Fowler Gaskin's boys being killed, I went over to try and comfort the old man. He let the truth slip. F and Luke did it. They were afraid to sneak up close, so they mistook Mike for you. It was you they meant to kill.
Me?
You just had a fight with them, and you whipped up on them pretty good.
I came awful close once to killing Isaac York.
Hate is a heavy load to carry, especially when it's for nothing.
Is Isaac inside the cabin?
He took an arrow. Shanty and Tom are doing what they can for him.
Rusty had dreaded going in, but it had to be done. He owed Isaac York for a wrong he was not sure he could ever set aright. Blessing and Shanty leaned over York, stretched out on a cot. A bloody arrow lay on the dirt floor. Blessing was washing a chest wound with a whiskey-soaked cloth.
Oh, don't you go and die on me, Mr. Isaac. You take a tight grip and hang on. You hear me, Mr. Isaac? I don't want to belong to somebody else.
It's bad, but it missed the heart. He'll make it. Guess it sort of makes up for him shooting those Indians on the reserve that time. When his time comes to die, it'll be the whiskey that kills him.
Preacher, you pray me through this, I swear I'll give up drinking.
The Lord expects a man to live up to his promises. Were I you, I wouldn't go making any I can't keep.
Mr. York, I'm sorry.
York became aware of Rusty's presence.
Boy, whatever troubles you got with me, they'll have to wait.
I've got no trouble with you. I'm sorry I ever did. I just found out what really happened to Daddy Mike. I found out it was the Gaskin boy shot him.
I had some differences with your daddy, but not nothing I'd kill him for.
Maybe someday I'll learn to be slow about making judgments. Forgive me, Mr. York.
Webb and Tom Blessing walked with Rusty as Captain Whitfield assembled the company.
Takes a man to admit he's wrong. Looks to me like you've grown up, Rusty.
I reckon it was high time.
You've taken a load off of Isaac York. The Lord is smiling on you.
He must be, because all of a sudden there's a load gone off of me, too. Come up to Belknap when you can, Preacher. There's folks up there who could sure stand some gospel learning.
Anything you want me to tell the Monahans?
Nope. I'll be going by and telling them myself.
The Rangers were riding away. Rusty spurred to catch up to them, thinking of what all he wanted to say to Geneva and to the rest of the family. His shoulder ached, but it was not enough to overcome the warm feeling that arose within. He had a family now. He was no longer alone. Buffalo Caller lay on damp ground. Looking up through a haze dense as smoke, he knew he was in the midst of timber along the bank of the river. He had fallen from his horse. His side burned like fire where the bullet had smashed his ribs. Carefully, he pressed his hand against the wound. He realized his life was draining away. He did not want to die lying on his back. He wanted to push up to meet death in a sitting position, but he lacked the strength. He blinked, trying in vain to clear his blurred vision. He sensed that a horseman was moving toward him. One of the Texans coming back to kill him, he thought. He felt no fear, for the Tabo could do nothing more to him. He was dying anyway.
father?
Steele's the ponies had found him. The young warrior knelt by Buffalo Caller's side. He gave the wound a swift appraisal.
I am here to take care of you, father.
It is too late. Even if I could ride, my horses went away and left me.
We lost all the horses, father, except the ones we rode. There will be other times and other horses.
For you, my son, not for me. Our grandfathers are waiting for me. You will keep fighting, Nertuar. Son, take my bow and my shield. Every time you fight the Texans, I will be with you.
I will fight them, father. I will fight until they are gone, or I am.
But beware the red-haired ranger. His medicine is stronger than mine. Stronger, perhaps, than yours.
Steele's ponies remained beside him after the strong heart had ceased to beat. He did not understand what his father had said about the ranger. Perhaps Buffalo Caller would come back in a vision sometime and explain. Texas Rangers, The Buckskin Lion is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1999, Elmer Kelton. Published by arrangement with Elmer Kelton, care of Sobel Weber Associates, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, David Coyne, Richard Rowan, Thomas Penny, Tim Getman, Jonathan Watkins, Christopher Graybill, Scott McCormick, Michael John Casey, Catherine Aselford, Ken Jackson, James Lewis, Andy Clements, Nanette Savard, Joe Brack, Casey Platt, Michael Glenn, James Konacek, Eric Messner, Colleen Delaney, Tim Carlin, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, Dylan Lynch, Tom Simpson, Laura Reichert, Johann Detweiler, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Greg Reinfeld. Adapted for graphic audio by Joshua Cristiano. With original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Texas Rangers, be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's series, Smoke Jensen the Mountain Man and The Last Gunfighter. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in Graphic Audio.
Smoke Jensen is an honest man trying to make an honest living.
I hear you're selling your stock, Smoke.
Most of it. Gonna raise horses, Monty. Oh, I'll keep a small herd, but nothing like we've had out at the Sugarloaf.
You using the rails?
I wish, Monty. No. This'll be a hard drive, all the way up to Montana, into a big valley. Town's called Blacktown. Fellow up there by the name of T.J. Dugan wants the whole damn herd.
But what Smoke Jensen doesn't realize is he'll be leading his herd right into the territory of the most notorious cattle baron in all of the land, Clint Black.
Well, the boys would be awfully disappointed. Do you really think this Mr. Black would harm a boy?
From what I've heard about him, I think he's probably capable of doing just about anything.
When Clint Black hears that Smoke Jensen is coming to town, he gets the idea to set an ambush and murder Jensen and his entire crew.
This is all that survived?
Yeah. We lost 13 all told.
The boys?
Willie, Jake, and Rabbit. They dragged Rabbit. Davey took a slug through the head. Johnson made a fight of it. Nate and Little Ben fought them to the end.
I found Jake's body. They shot him in the belly. He died hard.
But Clint Black will make one dire mistake. He'll leave Smoke Jensen alive and hungry for revenge. Don't miss all the blood-soaked action in Smoke Jensen number 10, Courage of the Mountain Man. In this one, everybody dies.
I'm hoping my brother will pull his horns and get straightened out.
Too late.
Why?
Because I'm gonna kill him, that's why.
Falcon, Mrs. Custer told me something that I'd never heard before. She told me that you were with her husband when he was killed.
I wasn't with him at the exact time he was killed. I was with Benteen and Reno when the general was killed.
Why haven't I heard this about you before?
Because my being there was an accident of sorts. A lot of good men gave their last full measure of devotion on that day. I never felt it was right to detract from their honor by interjecting myself.
I wonder, Falcon, would you share the story with me now?
It's been over 50 years, and I've never told this story to anyone before. I'm not sure I can do it justice. Well, I warn you, it's a long story.
I'm a novelist, Falcon. I deal in long stories. Please, go ahead.
Well now, the year 1876 was what historians would call an eventful year. In Philadelphia, they celebrated our country's centennial. Colorado became a state. They invented the telephone. And at a lonely place in Montana, General Custer and 265 brave men were killed.
Colonel McAllister, this way! Damn! You're one hell of an engine fighter, Falcon. I've been at this game for a long time. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
I'll be damned.
What is it?
The Colorado Home Guard is missing 100 rifles. It looks like we just found a few of them.
You mean in addition to the Gatling guns we're looking for, there's also a bunch of repeating rifles out there?
Sweet fancy Moses, look at that!
Have you ever seen that many Indians at one time?
No, sir, I have not. Two Bears was right, these engines is coming from everywhere.
We have to tell Custer about this. I don't think he has any idea what he's letting himself in for.
You don't really know the General all that well, do you?
I haven't known him very long. Why do you ask?
Because it ain't gonna make no never mind what we tell him. He has his mind made up to go after the engines, and that's exactly what he's gonna do.
We've got them this time! We've got them, boys! Trumpeter Martin!
Don't miss the saga of Falcon McAllister at the Little Bighorn and Eagles 14, Bloodshed of Eagles. Available now in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include five books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net.